The Contenders is a proud member of the Cage Club Podcast Network.
For other great shows about movies and pop culture, go visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
You having a nice time?
Can you keep a secret? I'm trying to organize a prison break. I'm looking for, like, an accomplice.
Maybe she liked the movies you were making in the 70s when you still were making movies.
Wasn't there anyone else there to lavish you with attention?
Does it get easier?
No. Yes. It gets easier.
Welcome to The Contenders, the show about the movies made by and starring women who refuse to play by the rules. I am Aislinn Addington.
And I am Tobin Addington. And today we're going to be talking about the winner of our poll. We had a poll of our Patreon members, those at the voting level or voting member or above, got to vote and choose which Sofia Coppola movie we would tackle first. And by a margin of, I think, 2-1, the film Lost in Translation won that poll. And so here we are to talk about that movie. Aislinn, do you remember the first time you saw Lost in Translation?
I do-ish. I remember that I saw it in the theater. And I kind of more so than the film, I remembered it was a hot topic of the era. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was, I think a lot of people loved it. And regardless of whether they loved it or not, a lot of people were talking about it. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So I remember the hype, but I saw it in the theater and then again yesterday.
Is it possible that you and I went to this in New York one time when you were visiting me in school?
It is entirely possible. I can't say for certain,
yeah.
But it seems likely in that I remember it as being an artsy theater experience, which could either be, you know, the Sixth Street place in Tacoma that I went to see movies like that, the Wilma in Missoula, or any number of hot spots in your orbit. So how about you, Tobe?
I don't remember exactly the first time I saw it, but I know that I saw it in New York. And I remember I was a few years into film school at this point, into grad school, and it blew me away. I was sort of transported by this movie and had a very profound experience. Came back home, and that summer took my then girlfriend, now wife, and her parents to it at the Wilma, and none of them liked it. I'm sitting there having this sort of ethereal experience, and they were sort of, I don't really get it.
I don't get it.
I don't get what the deal is.
Sure.
I don't understand why there's not more of a story. I don't, you know, like I think some like legitimate, you know, questions about the movie. Then since then, as I saw in more and more Sofia Coppola's movies, I liked this less and less. So I saw it one or two other times and did not care for it. And then about a year ago or a year and a half ago, watched it again and loved it again. So
what a roller coaster.
I've had a real roller coaster with this movie.
Excellent. You cut out there for a minute.
Okay.
So, but you've been on quite a roller coaster with it. Can't wait to dig in. But first, we have to do our other segments.
We do.
We are contractually obligated
yes.
to provide our audience. No, we do it all for the funds. So for the fun.
We sure don't do it for the money.
Hey, thank you so much to our Patreon contributors.
Yes, thank you. We do it for the money. We do this one for the money.
We did. Tobin, two
yes.
bits, please.
Yes, you got it. The first bit is that they didn't know if Bill Murray was going to show up to be in this movie. This is a common thing for Bill Murray movies, that he will never really commit to being in the movie until like the day before. So they were, the crew had gone to Japan. They were all set up. like they had their location, they had everything ready to go, just wondering if Bill Murray was going to show up the next day to be in the movie. And then he was. The second bit is that apparently the production didn't get permits for a lot of exterior and even some interior locations around Tokyo. And so it was sort of a sneak around, get what we could and move really fast. It was unclear to me from this newspaper article whether that's because it was difficult to get those permits or too expensive or what, but for whatever reason they didn't. And apparently the location manager resigned after one particularly horrible experience, as they're sort of, this person has been sent out to sort of talk to the people who want them out of whatever location they're in. So I feel bad for whoever that location manager was. Yeah. But anyway, so those are the two bits I got here.
Great.
Aislinn, can you take us through the women involved in major roles in Lost in Translation?
Would love to. Writer-director, Sofia Coppola. Lead actor, Scarlett Johansson. Supporting actor, Anna Faris. And editor, Sarah Flack. I'm glad you included Anna Faris. Tobin writes the outlines, everybody. Tobin does the majority of the behind the scenes work. I show up as talent does day of.
Yes, you're the Bill Murray of this podcast.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I am the Bill Murray of this podcast.
You bring the magic. You come at the end and bring the games and the magic.
We're gonna add that to our merch. I'm the Bill Murray of this podcast. I, for a while, as you know, was a huge fan of Anna Faris's podcast. And yeah. I'm not saying I'm not now, but we all ebb and flow with what we take. There's so much content out there. In any case, she mentioned with several guests brought up Lost in Translation. Mm. And she noted it as something that does stick with people. And and I feel like that's, again, originally when it came out, it was so much of a talking point. You have had a long up and down history with it. So it is something of a moment for people. And so even in that brief performance, in that caricature of a vapid actress performance, people remember Anna Faris for it. So I'm glad that we noted her here. All right. I am chomping at the bit to ask you a very important question. So please give us a plot summary so that I can keep talking.
Lost in Translation follows Charlotte, played by Scarlett Johansson, a newly married 20-something adrift in her marriage, her life, and the city of Tokyo, where she's traveled with her husband, a photographer who heads off on a photo shoot, leaving her alone for a few days in the hotel. A series of encounters with Bob Harris, played by Bill Murray, a past-his-prime movie star in town to film Japanese whiskey commercials, finds the pair to be in surprisingly similar melancholy places. As the two characters explore the contours of whatever their relationship might be, not quite lovers, not quite soulmates, not quite father-daughter, culminates in a wistful goodbye and a whisper from Bob to Charlotte that we will never hear. In the end, it seems that they've shared something as private as it was profound.
That was nice, except for the part where I mumbled gross under my breath, which I'm sure Tobin edited out, which leads to my question.
Okay.
I actually have two hot take questions, so I could pose them both, or I could pose one and then the other.
Okay.
So
I guess we should do one and then the other, because otherwise it might end the podcast right here.
Here we go. Okay.
Okay.
So, as I said, I watched it in the theater as a young person. I watched it last night as a less young person. Here is my question.
Okay.
What part of this story is any more than a middle-aged white guy's fantasy? So I'll give you beautiful to look at. I'll give you their chemistry was palpable. But middle-aged guy, kind of lost, kind of not knowing what's up, stuck in a place he doesn't understand, comes across a beautiful, much younger woman, as you say, in a interestingly parallel circumstance. And you know, they have hijinks, they have whimsy, they have some serious contemplative moments. There's jealousy, there's clear attraction, there's whatever. He leaves with a smile we haven't seen before.
Okay, so I'm going to set aside the intended snark of the question and tackle the seriousness of it, and just to give one possible read of it, is that I think that the material. So what Sofia Coppola has said in an interview with Vulture, I think, from a couple of years ago, was that her goal is to find stories and tell them from a different point of view. Is to find stories that we've seen before and tell them from a different point of view. This was most, I guess this article was pegged to the Beguiled movie, which does that in a kind of interesting way too. I think that there's something to the basic story as you laid it out could very easily be an old white man's fantasy. Two things I think give the lie to that. One is the fact that we start and end the movie with her, not with him, and that the movie seems to be more, if not at least as, if not more interested in her wistful wanderings, which, you know, mileage may vary on how how you know into that you are, but that it gives that equal that he is there as a reflection of her as opposed to the other way around. The second thing is that for a late middle-aged white man's fantasy, for them not to have had sex, I think that gives that's the second thing that gives the lie to it.
Okay. I take your points. I take the first one more than the second, in that, yeah, absolutely. She has early on this emotional experience at a temple of some kind, I don't know particularly, and is trying to talk to her friend about it. And yes, I would say I was, before they were kind of together in the same place, I was very interested in her backstory and kind of not how she got to this place, but in the kind of broader how she got there. So I think that, okay. I hear that. I can see how a different telling of this would be much more focused on him.
Or at least less focused on her, maybe.
Yeah. However, still the story it tells, is not satisfying for me. Sure. For her, and I don't know. I'm not going to give you a lot of credit for, well, he didn't do her.
I'm not asking you to give me credit. I'm saying that I'm imagining the version of this movie that I imagine when you describe that version, like when you say, "What about this is not a middle-aged man's fantasy?" I think the fact they didn't have sex is not part of the middle-aged man's fantasy.
Sure, he had sex with the lounge singer instead. Movie. Yeah, great.
Yeah. That's from her. That's sort of this is a different point of view on the a similar kind of story. Yeah.
I appreciate that. That helps me with it. It's still, I don't know, it's just I have a real meh for it.
It doesn't your critique does not sound meh to me. Your critique sounds like, let's check this whole thing.
No, I don't.
We've seen it before or whatever. I don't know. I'm putting words in your mouth. Like that was your hot take you came out with, as you said.
I don't think it's a terrible film, but if we're looking at it as movies about and starring women who refuse to play by the rules. I guess that's where I appreciate that twist on maybe an expected trope.
Sure.
But is it enough to make it fear or not fearless. Is it refusing to play by the rules? I don't know. And we can maybe, as we get into it more, we can talk about that. Can I ask you another hot take question?
Of course.
At what point is humor based on a language barrier simply racist?
Yes. Now we're getting to it. Yes. Okay. So here's my, so I think that the most egregious moments of this, and I'm going to give Sofia Coppola the benefit of the doubt that it was not intentionally racist, which doesn't make it better. I'm just want to put that out there. But the most egregious part for me was the part with the sex worker that is sent up to Bob's room.
Yes, that was uncomfortable.
Where I think we are meant to laugh at her mispronunciations, like we're laughing at her. We're not, you know, it's not about it's less about a language barrier thing than it is about, oh, isn't it funny that she's saying that she's using the L instead of the R, you know, like that felt like, oh, you know, that felt like over a line for sure. And there are some other places too, where it feels like the exoticism of this place is a little on display. I don't mind it as it did not strike me as egregious when she's seeing the flower arranging ceremony or going to the temple, or when she seems to be sort of observing this culture and sort of, you know, taking it in, as opposed to when characters, particularly Bob, are interacting with it. And in a way that then the movie's kind of like nudging us like, ha ha ha, isn't this funny? And that's the major critique of the movie. The one that lands the most for me is this, like, oh, I just wish it didn't. I wish it wasn't so racist in these moments. But I like the rest of the movie better than you. So I'm sure that lands even more for you.
I was also very uncomfortable with the sex worker scene, but I felt the example of the tension I had with the race and the tell me that one.
Yeah, one of those. Yeah, I don't know. I'm
also, when he was being directed in kind of both of the shoots that we're at, it just didn't feel good. And I think what makes it difficult is that Bill Murray is so funny, and his timing and his manner is really good. And so that's that. I don't know. Like, I think it would be different if he wasn't as good at playing this role. Right. Cause he's on the treadmill in the middle of the night and he can't get it to work the way he wants it to. Or, you know, that's funny there. Or, when he's in the bar, I think the first time, and the American businessmen are there and kind of trying to strike something up with him, and he just gets up and walks away. Like, he's
right.
I guess the charming isn't a good word for that exchange, but he's, you know, playing it so well. He's playing off the other people so well that it's a little bit disarming, but there was just so much. Like, I didn't remember. And it was a long time ago, but I just didn't remember so much of it being about L's and R's.
Yeah. And that scene where he's being the commercial directing scene does go on and on, you know, and it's, there's a funny, I shouldn't say it. I don't know, because I don't know how funny it is anymore. There is a clip on YouTube of Francis Ford Coppola, Sophia's father, being, I think it's an interview. I don't think he's being directed. I think it's an interview with a Japanese journalist from way back in the day, where they're having this language, like he can't understand what the questions he's asking him. That feels, when you see the two scenes side by side, it's hard to imagine that they weren't, there wasn't some kind of direct influence there. But yeah, it's so cringy. There's the cultural stuff is pretty cringy in those places for me.
That reality would feel like it was taking forever, right? If you were in that situation.
Right.
Leaning on it for humor or or kind of allowing it to grow up as humor just it didn't feel great. I think it could be solved is not the word I want to use, but like curtailed by someone mm-hmm. making a comment about, well, you know, how many languages are you fluent in? Right. Like none of them.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
That was kind of the other piece is rather than attempt, you get the Giovanni Ribisi and Anna Faris kind of like joke greeting each other in Japanese mm-hmm. or in stereotypical Japanese. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, right. if those common words are the ones that would be appropriate.
Accurate.
Yeah, but so yeah. I agree with you. I liked her explorations better than his, but also their their reasons for being there are so different. Kind of right, and especially they're setting that up a little bit, right? That they're in two very different places, but then end up together in whatever way.
Right. Can I offer a reading of this movie that I think might have more purchase? Okay, so in my research for this, I came across a scholar named Todd McGowan, who wrote a really interesting take on this movie, which is that he sees the movie as a critique of global capitalism.
Ooh.
And that what you have in the movie are these two characters who are both unsatisfied in their lives, and they're surrounded, they're sort of connected to these spouses who are seen as fully embracing excess. If you think about Giovanni Ribisi and sort of what he does, let alone like how he dresses and all this stuff, and then the stuff that we hear from Bob's wife, I did not look up her name. Lydia, that we see from Lydia are, you know, the carpet samples and the, you know, she's redecorating stuff, and that there's that the small bits and pieces that we see of these spouses, they seem to be more embracing of this. Whereas as our characters sort of find their relationship based on an absence of, so they seem unsatisfied with that. So they're wandering in search of a thing. And even to the point that the last scene in the movie, they, you know, their relationship, the movie it comes to a climax at a moment of absence. We're not even given access to the thing that they have. And so it's sort of denying us a thing in the way that they are sort of trying to find a way to exist in a place without this kind of excess, right? Like without sort of succumbing to, so even though what he's there to do is to make money from a commercial, right. But it's like, you know, like they're in the system. They cannot escape. This is not a movie about where they're going to, but he tries, right? Like he doesn't go to things. He doesn't do things. You know, he wants to escape from the, he's sort of feeling crushed by it, if nothing else. But I just thought that was an interesting sort of angle on this movie, which is not a way that sort of does away with the other criticisms, but just a sort of a different sort of point of view on the material.
Yeah, no, I like that. And I like the way, thinking about it like that, he makes the comment that he's there making $2 million instead of being in a play.
Right.
And that she's there because she doesn't know what else to do.
Right.
I did have a timeline issue because I'm picky like that of if she just graduated.
Yes.
And she's been married for 2 years. And then I don't know if he was serious or because Giovanni at one after the they meet Anna Faris.
Yeah.
And Charlotte could not. Because her name is Scarlett, and so the Scarlet Charlotte of it all.
yes.
Charlotte was unimpressed, and he says, well, not everyone went to Yale. And I don't know if that is just a fill-in for not everyone, you know, I feel like it could be not everyone went to Berkeley or whatever. If she's
name your school.
Right, because she was from New York and then moved to L.A. with him. So I was very confused if she was she doing all online courses, how, you know. How did she where did she graduate from? Which is not the point.
The academics. Where's your transcript?
It was the academics of it. Or because I could even think, you know, okay, well, we got married after she graduated, and now for 2 years she's been trying to figure it out.
Right.
Like that.
That's right.
That would have helped me. But I you know, I mean, there's when you're in it and you're making it. It's different than watching it 17 times later and having those weird little logic-y puzzles. That's just, you know, in the same way Ross on Friends should not have been getting tenure. He was
Right.
He was adjuncting for a couple of semesters and then suddenly got tenure. So
wait, that's not how it works? Oh, man.
Well,
I'm in trouble.
I suppose it depends on your institution.
Yeah, exactly. I guess.
Yeah. So Giovanni is in and out.
Yes.
What else about him? I wasn't upset by him. I felt like he was, you know, like the critique that you were talking about is just sort of a symbol of a different, you know, I mean, he seemed like his outlook was very different than hers.
Yeah.
But could also be that he is kind of suddenly making a career out of this. And in a different, the way that she described, was talking on the phone to her friend that now suddenly he's, you know, using hair gel and wearing whatever. His success has shifted, you know, kind of his aesthetic. But I guess I didn't get much from him, but I didn't need any more either. I don't know
how
about that character or their relationship, what we know of it.
Yeah, I felt the same way that it was. You sort of used just the right amount, and like that's plenty, you know. And now we can sort of move on. Mm-hmm. And So the rumor is, or I don't know how deep one wants to go into this, but that there was how much this movie is based on her life, right? Like how much of this movie is based on Sofia Coppola being dragged around the world by her famous filmmaker dad and like left alone in hotel rooms and sort of like wandering, you know, having sort of a wandering existence. And also that a lot of speculation, the Giovanni Ribisi character is based on her then husband, Sofia Coppola's then husband, Spike Jonze, and their relationship, at which ended between the time this movie was shot and the time the movie came out. And that the Giovanni Ribisi character, the kinds of things he's doing as a sort of photographer among celebrities, with like all the coolest bands, and that was kind of Spike Jonze's life, right? Like at that time. I don't know how much that needs to reflect in the movie or how much that we sort of, hold it against the movie in ways that I think gets done to her, done to Sofia Coppola. But so I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that? Did that impact your viewing of it, or what's your thought about that?
I didn't know the speculation about her marriage, but I guess I sort of thought, that was kind of at one time her deal, you know, having been part of a family that then is traveling around and share with me.
Yeah.
He's sort of, Francis Ford Coppola is sort of known for really digging in. I don't know how to say that better. But so I can see, you know, being in a place maybe longer than another director or I'm thinking about The Outsiders and his even down to like the casting, the way that was done, or the way they're put in the hotel in different floors and all that, that it's kind of the whole the whole package. It's a 24/7 deal, and so being on the outskirts of that would be, sorry, Toots was scratching and making a funny sound. would be like unsettling, because are you part of it or are you not? So that the lost bit, I felt like likely there's a connection there. I didn't know. I'm looking up now because I don't remember the order of her films.
Yeah, this is number two of the features. Virgin Suicides was first in 99.
Yes, okay. Because Virgin Suicides,
yes,
I have seen many more times than I've seen this movie.
Yeah, and for any other Virgin Suicides aficionados out there, Wistful Thinking, one of our sister podcasts at the Cage Club Network, is going to be covering that on April 4th. So we're celebrating Sofia Coppola here at the network.
And then I haven't seen Marie Antoinette. Apologies. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen Somewhere.
Uh-huh.
But I have seen Bling Ring twice.
Oh, you have?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow. How did that occur?
Well, I'm glad that you asked, because a good friend of mine, Dr. Brian Donovan, who you can hear today, if you flip on over to my other podcast, Why Aren't We All? He's the guest this month. He got mildly fascinated with with a television program, I believe, called Pretty Wild. Let me look and see if that was the title. Yes, that was an E! Entertainment Network reality show
about
family, about a mother and her three daughters. There's an asterisk there because there's blending, and so I could be wrong with the number. And she was homeschooling them, and they were very much, I don't know if it was The Secret, but it was something like that, that like their curriculum was manifesting your dreams. And they started filming the show, which was produced by Chelsea Handler, which is a whole other thing. But wow. Alexis Nears was her name. Implicated in the Hollywood burglaries that were depicted in the Bling Ring.
Okay.
So I had watched that because Brian was fascinated by it. And so then we all were for a minute. And then what was interesting to me, because I feel like the reviews on that were mixed at best.
Yes, indeed. Yep.
If you've seen any of this other footage, they're doing a great impression of that landscape. Leslie Mann plays the mother, and like the scene where they're in school, in quotes, is ripped from the reality show. I mean, Hermione watched the reality show to prepare for that role, I am confident. that just happened to be, I don't even want to say in my wheelhouse, but as people who know me know, I love trash television.
Yes, you do.
And
you
so, do. So I liked it, and I don't remember right this second. If we talk about that one, I don't think it's probably high on the list. but I certainly had some thoughts on the ways in which I thought it was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And then there, of course, are ways that don't. This is absolutely a better movie than that. Like I said, I feel like Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson's chemistry was amazing. Mm-hmm. I think they were the two people for these roles.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, doesn't Scarlett Johansson, or didn't she, have a reputation as being an old soul style? And I don't know if that is just in personality or in acting style or kind of
I think Ghost World had the most to do with it as the movie that sort of where people became really, I think that's the movie that, as I remember it, was the one people started to say, oh, Scarlett Johansson. And she had a series of roles that, you're right, sort of played on this kind of husky voice, old soul, deep eyed sort of dreamer that I think is what they're playing with here. Yeah.
You like a husky voice.
Yes, it's true.
You know,
it's true.
A cloth there to be cut from.
So let's if we may talk about Sofia Coppola a little bit,
sure.
Not just as a director, but as a, because I agree, I'm in the same boat. I have seen Virgin Suicides more times than any of her other movies. Mm-hmm. I've always felt like I like that one the best. Mm-hmm. And then it seems to be so, and this is going to lead into my question. My conception is that the movies kind of end up being less kind of potent telling of the same story over and over and over again. kind of from Lost in Translation down, which now, so that's my sort of perception and also the sort of like the cultural perception of her, I think, in general, among like cinephiles. Mm-hmm. My question is, and people have argued this, that that is a sexist, like what degree is the criticism of her sexist versus like an actual criticism of the movies themselves?
I think that's a fantastic question, because I think we could look at a number of male directors that are making the same thing over and over again to greater or lesser extents. Or I think it's a great point also because I have heard casually and with, you know, the learned crowd that you roll with, you know, a male director's point of view be kind of accepted and celebrated that like, oh, that's such a, that, I mean, I'm thinking of, because we're thinking of Bill Murray, then I'm thinking of Wes Anderson.
Right.
That's
great. Great. Yes.
it is all in the, well, many, not all. I'm certainly, because I'm not a huge fan. I haven't seen them all, and I haven't seen them all to the extent that people who love them have seen them all. But the world looks very similar, right?
Yes, agreed. Totally. You and I see eye to eye on him, I think.
Sepia-toned white people.
Yep.
Is just my headline for that. Now, giant asterisk, I love Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Me too.
Just watched it again, just for fun, not even because one of your kids wanted to watch it. I was the kid who wanted to watch it. But what's interesting to me is I know so many people for whom those films resonate.
Yeah.
And I happen to not be one of them. And so I'm not saying he's terrible and she's great, but it is interesting that he gets to have a point of view and a color palette and a series of familiar themes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, for, I think more often for a female director, which is difficult, right? Because there are fewer.
Yes, so few. Yeah.
Pattern wise, you know, I'm not gonna be able to show my work entirely, but I think that is an example of where the criteria we're using for innovation or raising a bar or even comparison is not. I don't like it. It's not working for me. I'm thinking of also like Farrelly Brothers.
Right.
You know, if you want to go a different kind of a different route or.
Oh, and I don't. But you could say like David Fincher, you could say Alfred Hitchcock, like, you know. Yeah.
And if you want to, you know, the. And because this was also written by her,
As
much as I love it, let's look at the Sorkin supercut, or let's listen to Joss Whedon quips, or, you know, other. I think men seem to be, and we need more evidence, so we need more women making movies. But I
thought you were going to say more men making.
Oh no,
movies.
We need more women making movies. men seem to be allowed to repeat their triumphs and mistakes in a way that women are not yet able to do at that level, because if it doesn't reach whatever bar is set out, then you might not get another opportunity, is what I've heard people who know a lot more than I do discuss it in that way.
Yeah, and the history of film, I mean, Elaine May comes to mind, who was with Mike Nichols. Nichols and May was the comedy duo. They were a comedy duo for a long time. He goes off, makes, you know, the Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate and on and on and on. And she makes three amazing comedies and then makes Ishtar and is never allowed to make a movie again.
Right, and Ishtar is a joke that I don't understand it. I know it's a joke.
Yeah, and it, because it costs so much money and lost a lot of money. But like, you know, even Michael Cimino, who made Heaven's Gate, who's like, that movie destroyed a studio. Like, United Artists went under because of that movie. And he still got to make movies after that. Not real soon. But, you know, but Elaine May, there's the original Heartbreakers is a, the original Heartbreak Kid is a wonderful movie. And A New Leaf is great. Anyway, the sort of history of film is littered with women who make one, you know, one movie that does not connect and then don't get to make another movie or are so bullied by the system they don't want to make another movie. You know, either way, it's important to note, I think, here that Lost in Translation marks the third time ever a woman was nominated for Best Director at the Oscars. Sofia Coppola won for screenplay and did not win for director, but it was the third time ever a woman was nominated. Ever.
Right.
So that sucks. I mean, it's good that she was nominated, but like, it sucks that it was the third in 2003.
Right.
Like,
well, and there was another 10 years.
Yes.
9 years.
Oh, how many?
Until
A Hurt Locker?
Hurt Locker.
Now we're looking it up. We're both
looking it up.
5 years.
That really? That was only 2008?
Yeah, because
God, time flies.
I mean, that's 11 years ago now.
I know, but I thought it was much more recently because I'm still upset. One of my supervisors in graduate school made me go on a work trip Oscar weekend. And so I was on a Southwest flight for most of the show. And we got to our hotel and I ran into the hotel bar and asked them to turn it on so that I could watch because it was highly anticipated that she was going to win.
To go back to the Farrellys, Peter Farrelly has won twice as many Oscars as women.
Oh my God.
Women directors have won.
I'm gonna throw up in my mouth.
So let's just sit with that for a moment.
No, thank
stew,
you.
Shall we?
No.
Oh,
thank
boy.
You.
But anyway, so I am ever since that came to light for me, the idea that how much of my sort of own feeling about the movies and the sort of what felt like the agreed upon sort of common wisdom about common take on Sofia Coppola, that she is sort of has a limited range of experience. This is this is all in quotes. Okay. This was sort of the take, right? That she's because she had this, famous filmmaker father, it was easier to get to make movies and she only knows about being little rich girl in these sort of hermetically sealed worlds and worlds of privilege. And I think that you can critique the movies. I think that there's some legitimate critique within that of like what is the point of view of this film and, what are we exploring with this and all that. But I have come to the feeling, especially as I've re-examined some of these movies, I do need to see Bling Ring. I've never seen it. But as I've come back and rewatched these movies, I thought there is more to this. It is what she's doing in terms of the language of cinema, in terms of the way she's using the shots, the way she's using her pacing. We mentioned Sarah Flack, the editor of this movie, as one of the women in charge. Sarah Flack is one of my all-time favorite editors. She edits all Sofia Coppola's movies and edited a movie called The Limey, a Soderbergh movie, Steven Soderbergh movie that I adore, that's got Leslie Ann Warren in it. For shout out to Victor Victoria. Yes. You know who you are.
Yes,
out
indeed.
There.
And Clue.
And Clue. Thank you. Yeah. So anyway, the her use of sort of intercutting, we're intercutting these two characters in this movie who we've talked about are in sort of somewhat similar places, sort of in their lives metaphorically, not often literally, like we're cutting between their distinct experiences for big chunks of the movie. And all that stuff feels so seamless to me. And I just think that there is much more interesting stuff going on in Sofia Coppola's movies than she gets credit for from some quarters who like to write her off as, quote unquote, the spoiled little rich girl.
Sure. I agree. And I would add that I can think of, and I don't know directors as well as I should in terms of, will you tell me a movie? I tell you who directed it. Not a game I'm good at, but I can make those same critiques of a handful of directors just off the top of my head. So if we're going to have those standards and we're going to be so critical to the point of dismissive,
dismissive. Right. Well said.
Then let's do it everywhere. And with the editing of these, great, because these characters don't overlap. I mean, they sort of bump into each other a couple times before they really are in a scene together, but you know, they're circling.
Right.
The backgrounds are similar and they're kind of moving in and out of different pieces of it for a long time.
A long time. So, yeah.
So what annoys me is somewhat limited to the story that I agree. The editing is fantastic. The way that it's shot is really pretty. I think the palette is so interesting because it's in a lot of ways dull, but then these bits of vibrance, you know, sometimes from the, you know, city skyline, sometimes from, you know, the whiskey in the,
right,
in the glass for, to the nutty, talk show, which in terms of the kind of cultural conflict of the piece, like that scene didn't even bother me that much. It was the other ones. And I think in part just because there are some the talk show setup is very different.
Yeah. He's the butt of that joke in a lot of ways. Yeah. He's very much the outsider in that, for even like we're seeing him as like that he's the fool in that. Like deliberately on purpose, like he's playing it, you know, but like, yeah, I feel like we're laughing at him in that as much as we're laughing at the, some of the Japanese characters and some of the other bits. Go ahead.
So in any of your watchings through your relationship with this movie,
yes,
were there points that you were hoping for them to get together? Because it's how about this? It's not the adultery that bothers me per se.
No, I don't think I ever wanted them to get together. What I loved is that, and what I've come to love, and I think maybe what I appreciated the first time is that the movie is playing with a relationship that they're not understanding, that they can't define as they're having it. And I like that it remains ambiguous and difficult. And I don't know. There's so many bad versions of this movie. There is the Farrelly brother version of this movie that is like, you know, just goofs on being in you know, Tokyo and like out and out. And there's a thing that I think it's one of the Coen brothers talks about. Directing is tone management. Every choice you make is about managing the tone. And I think there's no one is as good. There's no one's better at that than Sofia Coppola in the movies that I have seen. She knows exactly the tone that she wants, how she wants the moment to feel. It doesn't always, I think because of that, sometimes it you lose some of the, like these, the cultural sensitivity, and you lose sometimes the narrative thread and, you know, like other bits of, or what the relationship for a lot of people, it is just too ambiguous. And I totally get that. I never had the, I've always been very glad they didn't. What about you? Why?
No, it's been so long. I don't remember what I thought the first time. I think probably at that point I had a little more allegiance to Giovanni Ribisi.
Oh, interesting. Is that because of Friends?
I was going to say, you know, there's some Friends in there. I think there's some other 90s. I mean, we're in a Google Fest.
Is it Scientology?
I think certainly Friends is a component of it. And then he was in that early on. Oh, that remake of the Mod Squad.
Oh, right.
I know, that's a weird
poll. That's right, he was.
It's a weird
poll. Claire Danes and Omar Epps.
Yes. And of course, That Thing You Do.
Wow.
He's the fifth member. He's Chad.
Oh my gosh, you're right.
Chad fell down.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
God, speaking of amazing movies. Welcome to the That Thing You Do podcast. So what is your favorite scene or moment of this movie?
My favorite scene is the last conversation, the chase at the end. I think one of the things the movie is so smart about is that I think she was very smart to structure the movie as a romance, in terms of like the beats, right? So they had their meet cute, and then they sort of are circling one another, having their own sort of, you know, experiences. Then they come together and it's sort of an odd couple-ish match. And then they have a falling out. Mm-hmm. And then you have a race to the airport. Like, it's got all the beats, except that this race to the airport is not about, he's not trying to, stop her and whisk her off her feet and like marry her or whatever, right? Like the traditional end of the romantic comedy. He wants to tell her something to like mm-hmm. have, and she, I don't know. So I like that scene a lot. I also do like the scene where they're lying in bed together and he grabs her foot.
Yeah.
And that's a scene that they shot twice. They shot it once and the two of them weren't getting along apparently. And so they had the Sofia Coppola apparently said, well, let's try this again tomorrow. and then they just clicked. It all sort of worked together. What about you? Do you have a favorite scene?
I was going to say, I liked that. And I wrote in my notes, like, okay, now we're getting to it, because they had spent a lot of time out together, you know, for a couple of days. And in this watching of it, in the middle of it, I thought, oh, I should have been keeping track of days and nights, because it just seemed like a really long week. But, yeah. You know, they spent a lot of time together and then she knocks on his door when the lounge singer is still there, and they go have this very awkward lunch. And there's jealousy and weirdness and all this stuff comes up, where before it was just all the kind of fun and games. And then they reconcile. So they are in the bar having a drink before they have that conversation in the hotel room. And there I wrote in my notes, okay, now they're on a fucking date. Because they were also like, when they were holding hands there, I didn't like that. I felt uncomfortable with that. Uh-huh. But in that conversation where they were kind of really getting down to it and she was kind of being more sincere, I think, mm-hmm, with him, mm-hmm. That I did really like that scene in the with the last scenes, and I like them fine. I felt like they weren't sure if they were going to grab hands and run the way they had.
Interesting.
I felt like if one of them, they were waiting for each other. Each was waiting for the other to say,
interesting,
hey, let's go for it, or let's, you know, define this. Like, you know, like you say, it's ambiguous, too ambiguous for some people. Or that seems to be a critique. I felt like it was just that right on the edge where you don't know, mm-hmm, are we on the same page? Are we not on the same page? And so you both err on the side of caution. And they're in public, but, you know, also they're in Tokyo. So what is that?
What happens in Tokyo stays in Tokyo? Is that
the... Yeah, I guess.
One thing that I did like, and I'd love your take on it, because I wonder if it's different. One thing I appreciated about the scene where she had, the confrontation after he has had sex with the lounge singer, that it reads to me as though she is as upset by the fact that she feels jealousy as by his betrayal. And to me, where so much of the complexity comes in terms of her character, in terms of the real specificity about where she can't even quite articulate that. Mm-hmm. But what she's saying is kind of like, she seems to be grappling with the fact that she was like, why am I jealous about this? You know? And
yeah, like, what about this bothers me?
Yeah.
And then he puts it at attention.
Right.
Like, because I wasn't paying attention to you. Is that the problem? Which I think is also a, you know, why she was partially why she was upset with her husband. That's, you know, like, yeah, she's not having that emotional need met.
Right. Right.
And by him not being just so delighted to see her at his front door.
right.
Adds to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's the movie does not, I don't think that it goes out of its way to go easy on her in a way that feels authentic to life, as opposed to this is a female character, so we have to make them feel bad. Like, it feels more like it's coming from her than the movie sort of imposing it on her. Mm-hmm. And that's a difficult, I mean, there's a lot of kind of emotion and psychology in terms of, like, her, Scarlett Johansson having to play that, Sofia Coppola having to write it, and then us having to sort of, through the way she shot it and cut it, like, understand that. And that stuff for me is some of the stuff that works the best in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I did not like the giant plate of raw meat, but you know, that's always going to be an issue for me. These giant plates of raw meat as they happen.
Remind me to tell you a story about raw meat later.
Oh God. So Tobin.
Yes.
Do you want to play a game?
I do. How'd you know?
It's kind of a hard one. I'm sorry.
Oh, boy. Okay. I've been doing so well. It's
been doing
time
so
to
well,
crush
yes.
me.
So there is an easier version in the universe. I just don't have it. So we're going to play it the hard way. But it does have, you know, stakes and there are points available.
Oh, all right.
If you get an answer right with no hints,
okay,
you get 2 points. If you get it right after hints, you get 1 point.
Okay. Okay.
Your goal this evening is 10 points.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Or 8, whatever you'd prefer.
Okay. Is that the easier version?
No, let's say 8 points. Your goal is 8 points.
Okay. Okay. Good.
So, as you mentioned in your favorite scene, the final scene where he's leaving to go to the airport, Scarlett Johansson has left the hotel on foot. He stops his car to go find her. They embrace. He whispers something in her ear. We don't hear it. We see her face. It's on her face, not his. So we see how she reacts to it. Mm-hmm. And then they kiss. That's fine. And then he gets back in the car. He gets back in the car.
Yeah.
And then his face is different. And I like that. That's a different face than he had the rest of it. Okay, so
I'm imagining where he, like Mission Impossible, tears off his face and is wearing it. He's Philip Seymour Hoffman now or something.
He's Anna Faris all along.
yes. Oh, God.
So this leads to our game tonight. Okay. Famous last words.
Okay.
So I have the final line of a number of films.
Oh, amazing.
I will read it to you, and you will attempt to tell me what film it's from. So let's do a practice.
This is a practice
round.
Yeah.
How about this
one? Are you going to read it in character?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Because I haven't seen all the movies.
Okay.
But I picked ones I know you'd seen. So, for example, if I said, "There's no place like home."
Man, I hope it's The Wizard of Oz.
Absolutely. That's a great guess. Right?
I thought you might be throwing me and it's like some other movie that references The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm. So that was an easy one.
Okay.
They're harder than that.
No points, though. That was just for pride.
That was just for pride. Okay. Are you ready?
I am.
Ernest Hemingway once said, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for." I agree with the second part.
Oh, God, I know that, too. I've seen it recently.
Really? Do you want a clue?
Not yet. Oh, my God, I know this. I just saw this recently. Okay, give me a clue.
Have you been watching movies from 1995 recently?
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. always.
Mm-hmm. The title has letters and a number in it.
Oh, it's seven.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's seven. Yeah, it's and you didn't do your Morgan Freeman voice.
I didn't know who said it.
Yeah, Somerset, Detective Somerset says it. Yes. Okay. Right. Yes. Okay. Yep. Damn. Okay. But I get
good.
one point, right?
That's good.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. How about this? You met me at a very strange time in my life.
Oh, I need clues.
It has one of the same lead actors as the previous question.
Very awkward time in my... Is it an awkward time in my life?
You met me at a very strange time in my life.
Okay, so it's a Brad Pitt movie. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, Mr. and Mrs. Smith?
No, I'm sorry. Oh. Fight Club.
Oh, man. Okay.
You know, yeah. How about this one?
Okay.
After all, tomorrow is another day.
Gone with the Wind?
Yes! Good work! Okay, this one I'll try to do in character.
Oh, good. Okay.
It was perfect. My acting wasn't great on that, I'm sorry.
Oh, my God.
I wouldn't win the Oscar for that performance.
But did this person win the Oscar?
I think so.
Okay, give me a year.
2010. That's way too much information for you. Well,
No, it's not. I don't know why, but like the difference is like that's 90s versus the like 2000s. Sure. It was perfect is what the line?
It was perfect.
Okay, give me another clue cuz I don't know.
Precision, austerity.
Do I like this movie?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Is it okay? So let me ask this: what did it win for an acting category?
Yes, this person won.
Okay, I'm not Googling it.
Okay,
because that would be not fair. 2010 mm-hmm. was it best actor, best actress?
Best actress.
2010. Okay, I need more. Can you give me the other like the other star of the movie?
Like the name of the other star?
I don't know. I need more clues. I don't know what it is. Well, you don't have to give me points. I don't need points, but I want more clues. You don't know if I like it or not. It's the best actress winner.
It blended art forms.
Oh God.
This actress swept this season. It's kind of a,
it's won everything.
Yeah. Kind of a comeback. Here's where you'll get it. She credits this experience with giving her her family.
Oh, my God.
She has a family. Sorry, I didn't mean for this to be a stumbler.
Oh. Yeah, give me one other clue. Wait. Art forms? You said combines mm-hmm. art forms?
Mm-hmm.
Is it Natalie Portman in Black Swan?
It is.
Oh my God. That was way too hard.
I give you a happy.
No, not hard. I mean, it was totally fair. I should have gotten that is what I'm saying.
So the better version of this game is me giving you two options and you telling me which one is correct.
Oh, this is good. I got two of them.
You did. You absolutely did. So 3 points, 3.5 if we give you a happy for that.
Yeah. 3.5. 3.5. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
How are you? And how about the year is not a clue?
Okay. Yeah. That's helpful. Yeah.
From the year 2000.
Okay.
The final line is. Now, where was I?
Oh, is this one of the Austin Powers movies?
No.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay. So it's not a spoof. It's something much more serious.
Where was I?
Is it a James Bond movie?
No, but you're closer.
Sometimes the James Bond movies ends with like him then back in bed with the woman from the early end. Like, now where was I?
That would be a good line. No, this is more like sincere confusion.
It must be a memento then.
It is memento.
Oh, okay.
There we are.
All right.
Okay, this one I'm not going to be able to do in character because I have not seen this film.
Okay.
But it is a classic from 1971.
Okay.
God.
I was cured, all right.
Oh, it's One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest.
No, you're so so ridiculously close, though, Tobin.
Oh my God! It's not One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest.
No, but you're in the right canon.
Okay, but you mean like mental institution movies, or you mean like Jack Nicholson movies?
No, I was thinking like director, unless I'm wrong.
Oh, like Milos Forman movie. This is a Milos Forman movie.
Okay, I'm sorry. You're going to have to cut this out. I thought Stanley Kubrick directed One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest.
No, Milos Forman.
Oh, pardon me. I've already admitted to, I don't know directors as well as I should. Do you see why I thought that, though?
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure. So this must be A Clockwork Orange.
Yes.
Okay. Which I've only seen once in college.
See, I feel like that would be a strong one for you.
No, I like Kubrick a lot, but that one is too much for me. It's like Fight Club. I don't need to see it again. I've seen it once. Sure. And, you know, it's like I don't need to be hit in the face by a movie every time I watch it. So, yeah.
This one is famous, but I'm not sure. So I'm sure you'll find it familiar. Okay. I don't know from what. Roads, where we're going, we don't need roads.
Yes. Is that Back to the Future?
It is. Good work.
Yes.
See, I would have recognized it, but not known what it was from.
Now, okay. That's 8.5 points.
Is it?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3.5.
And then
4, 5, 6, 7. You're right. You won. Now, hold on, though, because I saved my favorite for last.
Wait. I'm sorry. 7.5. 7.5.
Perfect. So in order to win, you need to get at least 1 point on this. Okay. Are you ready?
Okay. I am. On Golden Pond. No.
Oh man, that would be amazing. No, but you're.
I'm in the area. Okay.
Creeping toward the area, I would say.
Okay.
1959.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, nobody's perfect.
Something Like It Hot.
Yes, you got it. Good work. That was such a hard game. You did so well.
I'm embarrassed because I'm in the middle of teaching a history of cinema class and I did not get many of these, although I got most of the vintage ones. So
absolutely. I feel
better about that.
And,
that was a really good game. That's a really fun game.
The list was hard because some of them were real easy, like Wizard of Oz. And then some of them were ridiculous. Like,
yeah,
I love you is the last line of Rocky.
Oh, I've never seen it.
Right. That's
so I'm glad you didn't do that one.
Yeah. Or, you know, Usual Suspects, Jaws. I mean, there's a lot that I just had to.
What's the last line of Jaws?
I used to hate water. I can't imagine why.
I would have gotten that one.
That's is why I didn't do it.
Yeah. Okay.
I felt like that was too easy.
I see. Yeah.
And then there's the whole section of ones I had to throw out because they had the name of the film
of the movie in it. Oh, that's just tacky. That is
like,
just
Shane,
tacky.
Shane, come back.
Yes. That's just tacky.
Or yeah. Green Mile, you know. In any case, nice work. 8.5 points.
Thank you.
Excellent job.
Very exciting. All right, now is the time in our podcast where we decide if this movie is progressive or regressive. Is this a step forward or a step back for fearless women in front of and behind the camera? Islin, what say you?
I am putting it right in the middle. I don't think this, from my viewpoint, this is, on the whole, not particularly progressive. I think the behind the camera elements are more progressive than the story, but it just... It didn't, I don't think the character in front of the camera was fearless enough for me to put it on the progressive side. I don't think it was harmful. Gender-wise, I think, as we have discussed, the racial and cultural pieces are problematic. And so for me, I'm just going to sit in the middle and say, it's beautiful to look at. What do you think, Tobe?
I am going to say progressive. This movie on the just on a personal level, I do. And maybe because I am approaching middle-aged white man, the movie makes me cry. I get misty at this movie at the end, and I love the way it explores. I don't identify as much, at least I hope I don't identify as much with Bob, but I do identify with her, and that sense of sort of being lost and wandering and making a connection you don't fully understand. And I think that I have come around on this movie back to where I sort of started with it, I think. And then I think it's kind of magical. I think this movie's for all of its problems. And the fact that it was so purely her vision, mm-hmm. and that she brought that vision to fruition, I think that makes it, I think she had to be somewhat fearless to get this movie made this way. And so I say progressive. Aislinn, what are we going to talk about next time?
Speaking of magic.
Yes.
Next up, we're going back to the future, as it were, to a current film. We're going to discuss Captain Marvel from 2019. So get thee to a movie theater if you haven't gone yet. That will be coming in 2 weeks on April 16th.
I'm so excited to talk about that movie with you.
I am too. For our listeners, we have not discussed it a stitch with each other.
Not a bit. Unless she's read my Twitter feed, in which case I've gone on about it at some length.
It's just so embarrassing. I have not.
That's what I knew I was saying.
It's been a rough couple of weeks, folks. But my one of my students, who is an often listener, hello Keith, remarked to me that you were tweeting about it a lot. So
yep, I was.
I'm in preparation for that. Very excited. April 16th, come on back. Tobin, where can people read your tweets about Captain Marvel and other things?
They can find me on Twitter at Tobin Addington.
And you can find me on Twitter at SassyNerdMT. You can find us on Twitter at Contenders_pod or on Patreon at thecontenderspod.com. Special thanks to our members who've joined at the marquee level or above, Sean Flynn and Jeff Addington.
We here at The Contenders are proud members of the Cage Club Podcast Network. You can explore all their great shows at cageclub.me, like Wistful Thinking. Don't forget, on April 4th, they are going to have their episode on the Virgin Suicide. So catch up with them and listen to more about Sofia Coppola. Find them at cageclub.me or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Wistful Thinking. And you can keep tabs on all the Cage Club happenings on Twitter at Cage Club Pod. As always, thank you so much for listening. I am Tobin Addington.
I'm Aislinn Addington, and we'll see you next time on The Contenders.
I didn't get a chance to use it.
That's how it should end every time.
Yes. I got to open back up our thing here. Is it probably me? It's probably me.
It is you.
Yes. Okay.
According to my notes.